much for giving me this opportunity. I'll be talking to you about spinner condensates in two dimensions, more specifically about the superfluid transition in these systems. This is work that's been done at UC Berkeley in collaboration with Zhengke Xu, who was a graduate student and will be starting as a Harvard Junior Fellow very soon, and Joel, who's here. So this is what I'll be talking about. Most of my talk will focus on So most of my talk is going to focus on the first topic here, which is the superfluid transition in spin one spinner condensates. And you can read more about this in this particular paper, which is in First Rev Letters and also on ConMat. And if time permits, I'll talk a little bit about certain dynamical issues in these condensates at finite temperature. And I won't be going into too many details there, but if you're interested in the details, there's a recent paper on the archive about this. Okay, so why spinner condensates? Well, spinner condensates are interesting because the bosons involved have an additional spin degree of freedom. So the broken symmetry is more than just U1. And this additional degree of freedom gives you many interesting phase transitions and topological effects and a lot of interesting physics. And from the point of view of a theorist, you know, it's especially good that these things aren't really a figment of a theorist's imagination and that they've been realized experimentally in the last 10 years and have been very actively studied. Now, why two dimensions? Well, two dimensions generally turn out to be interesting, and you have unconventional phases and phase transitions both in a classical and in a quantum context, where topology is quite often a very important feature. So the topological defects that I mentioned here become especially important in two dimensions. And once again, two-dimensional atomic BECs are also not a figment of a theorist's imagination, and they've also been realized experimentally in the last couple of years. Okay, so what do we know about the superfluid transition in a two-dimensional system for the more familiar case of spinless bosons? So this particular transition is the celebrated Kostolits-Thouless, something which is also called the Bosinski-Kostolits-Thouless transition. And it's characterized by the fact that the superfluid density jumps discontinuously at the transition temperature, and the jump has a certain value, which is given by this. M here is the mass of the bosons involved in the condensation. Now, even though this is discontinuous, the transition is not discontinuous in a thermodynamic sense, because the free energy only has an essential singularity, and that is reflected in the fact that the specific heat at the transition temperature doesn't do anything peculiar. It's actually reasonably well behaved with a weak essential singularity. But in some sense, this is really the most striking feature of the transition. So this was predicted theoretically in the early 70s and was then seen experimentally in the late 70s in thin helium films in an experiment done by Bishop and Reppe. And what they did was they used something called a torsional oscillator technique, where you had an oscillator that was in contact with this two-dimensional system, and depending on whether it was rubbing against a superfluid or not, the oscillation time period was a certain value. And as you can see, and the time period of oscillations depended on the superfluid density. So you could see that in the experiment, the time period of oscillations dropped discontinuously at a certain temperature, indicating this discontinuous drop in the superfluid density. So this was done in the late 70s. Now the obvious question is, can something like this be seen in an atomic BEC in two dimensions? Well, so doing an experiment of the sort that Bishop and Reffy did is difficult because it's very difficult to put an oscillator into these systems. You know, there'd be heating effects, and it's just not possible to do the experiment the way they did. So the question is there some other method by which you can, in a two-dimensional atomic BEC system, look at this Kostolits-Thouless transition? And that was done quite recently by Hatzi Babich and collaborators, and they looked at this particular BEC system, rubidium-87 in a magnetic trap. Now, rubidium-87 is a spin 1 atom, but when you put it in a magnetic trap, you're freezing out the spin degree of freedom. So you're putting it in one particular, you're putting all the atoms in one particular SZ state, so it becomes like a system of spinless bosons, which should have that kind of costless Salis transition. Now, the technique that was used was an interference measurement. So in addition to the superfluid density, in addition and related to the superfluid density jumping discontinuously, you also have a change in the form of the correlation function as you do, as you develop algebraic order below the Costless-Salis transition. And so, you know, above the Costless-Salis transition temperature, if you look at the order parameter correlation function, it only has short-range correlations. And exactly at the transition, it becomes just like in any other transition, algebraically ordered with a certain value of the exponent, which is of course related to the jump that I showed you earlier. So the idea in this experiment is to measure the value of the exponent of the order parameter correlation function directly. And the technique used is an interference technique, and I'll just very briefly go over what they've done because, you know, this slide is perhaps a little too terse. So what they do is they trap these atoms in a magnetic trap in three dimensions, and then they switch on an optical lattice along one of the dimensions in such a way that they get two films, two-dimensional films of the system. Now, they let the films expand in this region, you know, between the two films, and through probe beams capture an interference pattern in this plane. So in this diagram, it's in the XZ plane. Okay, now it turns out that if you look at this interference pattern and if you look at the modulation of the interference pattern in the Z dimension, there is a particular modulation which actually captures correlations within each of these condensates independently. Correlations within each of these condensates. Now, the assumption in this particular experimental technique is that these two condensates are independent in the sense that the correlations between them are not linked, but they're also identical in the sense that if you look at each of these condensates separately, they have the same correlations. They have essentially the same correlation function as a function of distance. So now it turns out that, you know, if you look at that particular modulation along the Z direction, and then you integrate along the X direction, and in this particular experiment, the Y direction is actually much smaller than the X direction. So in some sense, just from the fact that you're capturing an interference pattern in the XZ plane, you're automatically already integrating along the Y direction. So as you integrate along the X direction, you end up capturing the square of the order parameter correlation function. This is the length in the x direction that you're integrating over. So you can actually measure this quantity directly, and this turns out to be of this particular form if you do the integral with an exponent alpha. Now, if the correlations are short-ranged, then alpha, you know, if this is an exponential function, then alpha turns out to be equal to 0.5. On the other hand, if you have some algebraic correlations, then alpha gives you an exponent related to the exponent of the algebraic correlations. And in particular, exactly at the KT transition, it turns out that alpha is equal to 0.25. So in this kind of experiment, if you could do measurements of the function of temperature, and if you measure this exponent alpha, you'd expect to see a jump from 0.25 to 0.5, the jump in the previous experiment that I showed you. Now again, you know, measuring temperature in experiments of this sort is very difficult. So what they do is they sort of quantify temperature by looking at the number of atoms, if you like, in each of these films. So, you know, so they have a certain frequency, and by changing the frequency, they can evaporatively cool these films, and by cooling, you're just simply evaporating a certain number of atoms, removing it from the system, from the condensate, if you like. And the number of atoms in the condensate are going to be proportional to the contrast of the central fringe that you see. And the more atoms you have, the smaller that contrast is. And the fewer, yeah.
So they had just two films, or they had the whole bunch?
No, they had just two films. Okay, so, well, I guess what they, how do they have exactly two films? I didn't see any details of that particular thing in this paper, but you know, they, so the optical lattice, you know, they have these two very deep sort of quantum wells of these things. They somehow produce that pattern, and they're deep enough that there's no tunneling. But why there aren't any other films, why you don't produce any other films, I don't really know. Okay. So the average central contrast is something which goes down as the number of atoms increases. That's a contrast of the central fringe, and it goes up as the number of atoms decreases. So you can use that in some sense to quantify temperature. So increasing temperature on this particular plot is in this direction as you go to the left. And you can see that there is a jump in this exponent alpha from 0.25, which is what you'd get for the KT exponent, the Costa-Salis exponent, to about 0.5, which is what you get for short-range correlations. Now this data is not as clean as the Bishop and Reppe experiment, because there are a bunch of approximations, if you like, involved in this kind of analysis. But it does show you that there is a jump which is very much like what you'd see in a KT transition. So that was one experiment which has been done in a two-dimensional geometry. There are other experiments which have also been done, and this is one which has actually been done in an optical trap. So here you're not freezing out the spin degree of freedom. And so this is two-dimensional in the sense that the system that you form actually has a size in a particular dimension which is smaller than the spin healing length. So in some sense, it's two-dimensional for the spin. And in this particular experiment, what they do is they look at the formation of magnetic domains in this two-dimensional film as a function of time with some sort of initial quench. And I guess this is probably a little too bright, but each of these is a snapshot of the two-dimensional film at a different time. And they have a way of actually imaging the magnetization, which ends up actually lying in this particular case in the plane of the film. So they have a way of imaging the direction of the magnetization, and these colors really correspond to different directions of the magnetization. So this is another experiment which has been done in a two-dimensional geometry in BEC systems recently. Okay, so now I'm going to talk a little bit about the theory of these systems, and this has been mentioned in one form or the other in a series of talks so far, so I'll just go over this once again and quickly. So in an optical trap in which, in any trap really, you can approximate the two-body potential between the bosons to be of this particular form, and this was sort of used and justified by Jason Ho and Tony Leggett, among other people. Now this assumption, the validity of this form rests on a number of assumptions, one of which is that only S-wave scattering is important. So you assume that, which is true in these traps, that the temperature is so low that the kinetic energy that the bosons have is much smaller than any characteristic energy scale that's associated with the two-body interaction potential. If you put in numbers, this typically is of the order of nanokelvins, and this, I think, is of the order of microkelvins or so. If you actually look at the two-body interaction potential between these bosonic atoms, this turns out to be of the order of microkelvin. So this condition is satisfied. So that tells you that only S-wave scattering is important. In addition to that, there's usually some sort of a diluteness condition. These are really dilute systems, which lets you approximate the true two-body potential as just a contact delta function kind of potential. So the important thing is that this is the form of the two-body potential in these traps. In an optical trap, if you have spin 1 atoms, and because these are bosons, you're considering only S-wave scattering, and the interaction is already a delta function, the only choices available to you for the spin part of the interaction of the two atoms is something of this form, where you have a constant times a spin, where you have a constant times a projection into the spin 0 sector of the two spin 1 atoms, and the spin 2 sector of the two spin 1 atoms. Spin 1 is prohibited because of both statistics. The two standard spin 1 atomic systems are sodium 23 and rubidium 87, and it turns out that both G0 and G2 are greater than 0 from calculations using atomic parameters. These turn out to be greater than 0 for these systems, so it's repulsive in both sectors. However, the difference between these two quantities is different for these two atoms, and that's what really distinguishes their physical behavior. So to see that, the best way is to write down the two-body potential in this form. So this is This is the two-body potential in terms of projection operators. Now you can remove the projection operators by inserting the identity and this particular combination of the spins, S1 dot S2, because you know these are spin one systems, and the new constants C0 and C2 are linearly dependent on the old constants G0 and G2. C0 is something which is, you know, some which is basically a sum of the two with some coefficients in front, but C2 is the difference of these two quantities, and it can have either sign depending on which one is larger, and it's exactly the sign of C2 which distinguishes sodium 23 from rubidium 87. So this one has an antiferromagnetic coupling. C2 is greater than zero, which is also sometimes called polar, and this has a ferromagnetic coupling because C2 is less than zero. Okay. So now, given that particular form of the two-body potential, one can write down a many-body Hamiltonian, which looks like this, where because these are spin one atoms, I now have labels A, B, A prime, and B prime, which go from, you know, which have basically three values, plus one, zero, and minus one along some quantization axis. And you know, just for the sake of completeness, I've also thrown in the possibility of there being a trapping potential, which actually does exist in a real experimental system. But having put that in, I'll promptly set that to zero for the rest of the talk and just look at sort of the uniform state. So if this is equal to zero, the mean field ground state from this Hamiltonian happens to be one which is uniform in space. It's a Q equals zero state with where you can actually write down the order parameter, if you like, as a complex scalar field for each of the three components. Now, you might worry about what's called spin fragmentation, and the best way to talk about this is to look at what happens if you have, say, an antiferromagnetic interaction between two bosons. So if you have two bosons with an antiferromagnetic interaction, the ground state is something which is a two-particle singlet, okay? And then if you have, say, an even number of bosons, the spin of the ground state is going to be, you know, is really going to be zero. And if you look in the spin sector, the ground state is actually going to be an n particle singlet, which doesn't look like a mean field ground state like this, where each particular spin component has a certain scalar field associated with it. But it was shown by Yipin Ho in 2000 that as you reach the thermodynamic limit, the ground state of the system, the mean field ground state of the system, is indeed a BEC state of this kind, where what happens is that the singlets that you form become degenerate in energy with this particular mean field ground state, along with certain, you know, excited states that you form in a finite system. As you go to the thermodynamic limit, all these become degenerate and you end up actually getting a mean field ground state. This is sort of like the Tower of States argument that you used to say that, you know, the nail state is the ground state of the 2D Heisenberg model or something. It's similar in spirit to that. Okay, so now with the mean field ground state, we can write down the energy of the condensate in this particular form. But what I've done is I have pulled out a density. N is just the density of the condensate. So I had defined these complex scalar fields in the previous slide. So in this slide, I'm going to define new complex scalar fields where with the density pulled out, and define a spinner, which is just basically a column vector with these scalar fields. So this now has a length which is equal to one, and I can define this average spin operator, which is just this particular quantity. So in terms of these quantities, the mean field Hamiltonian that I wrote down reduces to a particularly simple form, which is this. Now, if you look at this energy, you will see that it is invariant under gauge transformations and spin rotations of this particular column vector. So what I mean by that is the following, that if I make a transformation of a given column vector X to a form which is like this, with a phase in front and a rotation matrix, that doesn't change the energy. And this rotation matrix is the rotation matrix for SO3 rotations. You know, this is integer spin, so spin rotations are SO3. I mean, the representation of SU2 for integer spins is SO3. And I can very conveniently parameterize this particular spin rotation matrix with three Euler angles. alpha, beta, and gamma. So these are, this theta, alpha, beta, and gamma are the four angles, if you like, which parameterize equal energy manifolds of this particular system. But what we're interested in is the ground state, the mean field ground state in the two cases of ferromagnetic and antiferromagnetic coupling, and this is how we generate them. So if you look at the ferromagnetic state, if you look at the ferromagnetic system, that is characterized by C2 less than zero. So if I go back to my previous slide for a second, the value of S squared, which minimizes the energy for C2 less than zero, is the maximum possible value it can have. And that happens to be one in this particular way of doing things. So the ground state manifold is basically the manifold of all states which have this S squared equal to 1. Now, what we'll be interested in is looking at sort of the topology of this manifold, because that will allow us to concentrate on the topological defects, which will eventually be important for the 2D superfluid transition. So how do you generate the entire manifold? So the way you do it is you look at one particular state, which actually does have this feature, and a very simple state is 1, 0, 0. Remember, this is plus 1, this is 0, and this is minus 1. I mean, these are the projections which are plus 1, 0, and minus 1 along some axis. So you pick some particular z-axis and look at just the state which has a plus 1 projection, and that obviously has S squared equal to 1. And you can now generate the entire manifold by hitting this particular state with the U1 cross SO3 transformation that I written down. So you hit the state with this particular combination of four angles, and it turns out that the most generalized spinner, the most general spinner in this particular case has this form. Okay, but what's interesting here is that even though you started with four angles, this thing is really parameterized by three angles, because when you hit 1, 0, 0 with this particular combination, theta and gamma combine in a particular way and form an Euler angle. So this is really parameterized by three Euler angles, alpha, beta, and theta minus gamma. And as a result of that, the ground state manifold is isomorphic to SO3, which is also parameterized by the three Euler angles. So that's what happens in the ferromagnetic case. Now, in the antiferromagnetic case, one can proceed in the same way. So now C2 is greater than zero, and the energy functional is minimized by an S squared, by the value of the minimum possible value of S squared, which is equal to zero. And again, you can generate the manifold by picking one state which has this particular property and hitting it with this general U1 cross SO3 transformation. And in this particular case, that one state happens to be, this representation happens to be 0, 1, and 0. And when you hit it with general U1 cross SO3, what happens is that one of the Euler angles actually now disappears. So gamma drops out of the final form, gamma drops out of the general spinner having this property, and this is really parameterized by three angles, alpha, beta, and theta, but these are not Euler angles anymore. In fact, it turns out that alpha and beta pick out a direction in space, and theta is an angle, so this is really parameterized by a direction and an angle, something which was pointed out by Fei Zhao as well. And one of the interesting things about this particular state is that it has a certain kind of invariance, which is that you can change the phase angle by pi and also invert this particular direction, and that leaves the state invariant. So what these quantities mean in physical terms is this represents a particular direction of the spin quantization axis relative to which this mean field state has spin projection zero, and theta is just the phase of the condensate, and there is this particular symmetry between the spin quantization axis and the angle, and the phase. So in terms of group theory, if you like, this manifold is actually isomorphic to U1 cross S2 mod Z2, U1 coming from this, S2 coming from that, and a global Z2 identification which takes into account this particular invariance. And the Z2 is something which was missed in earlier works and is going to be important from the point of view of topological defects. Okay, so that's what the ground state, the mean field manifolds of these two systems look like, the ferromagnetic and the antiferromagnetic systems. Now, it turns out that there are other condensed matter systems in which you have the same kind of ground state manifolds, and one of them is this particular system, an incommensurate spin density wave in a Mott insulator. This is something which was pointed out by Zhang, Sachdev, and Demler. And there, you know, you have a spin density wave, and you could along one direction, and you could basically have either a non-collinear antiferromagnetic state, where you sort of form some sort of, so you have one direction along which you have the spin density wave, and then you could have a circular state in the direction that is perpendicular to this lattice direction, and have a non-collinear antiferromagnetic state, and it turns out that this actually has a ground state manifold, which is SL3, or you could have a collinear antiferromagnetic state, where it turns out that the ground state manifold is exactly like that for the polar case. So these are sort of like exactly like the ferromagnetic spinner and the polar spinner that we talked about, but in a different context. And you know, since helium-3 was mentioned in yesterday's talk for a little bit, this particular ground state manifold also happens to be the ground state manifold of a particular form of the A phase in helium-3, the so-called dipole-locked A phase. And you also see it in the classical triangular lattice Heisenberg antiferromagnet. So there are analogs of these manifolds in other condensed matter systems. Okay. So our goal in identifying these manifolds was really to look at the topological defects, and so that's what we're going to do next. And the way you look at topological defects given a particular manifold is using something called homotopy theory. So what you do is you look at closed loops within a manifold, and you see whether or not they're contractible to a point, whether they're contractible to a point or not, and families of these loops correspond to topological defects on these manifolds. And these particular loops or topological defects form a group where which is called the first homotopy group, and the group operation is really the concatenation of these defects or the concatenation of these closed loops on this manifold. And what's interesting is that this homotopy group of topological defects need not always be abelian. Although in this particular case, in the two cases that I'll discuss, the homotopy groups will turn out to be abelian, but they need not be abelian. And this was mentioned briefly by Ashwin in his talk. I mean, you do see examples of that in spin 2 condensates, and not in spin 1 condensates. Okay, so let's first look at the ferromagnetic condensate. And so how do you identify the topological defects of this? So this is something where the ground state manifold is isomorphic to SO3. Now, SO3 is something which you can show is basically like a three-sphere, the surface of a four-dimensional sphere, with diametrically opposite points identified. So you can also write it as S3 mod Z2. And so now if you look at the topological defects, or if you look at the family of closed loops which are contractible or not contractible, it turns out that there are only two such possibilities. One is basically a contractible loop. So you take any point on this three-sphere and you draw a loop along the sphere, and you can contract it continuously to the point, to this particular point. So that's one family. And the other family is where you draw a loop like this, which joins diametrically opposite points, and you can see that there's no way of contracting this loop to, and this is a closed loop because these two points are identified, they're considered to be the same, but there's no way of contracting this loop into a point without, you know, removing it from the surface of this manifold. So this is the other kind of non-contractible loop, and if you concatenate two of these, you can show that you actually end up with one of these. So because you have two classes of closed loops, the homotopy group ends up being a two-parameter group which has the same group property as Z2. So the homotopy group of this is actually Z2. Now, the topological defects of the other manifold are more interesting. And so the other manifold doesn't have as simple a geometric representation as SO3. So this is U1 cross S2 mod Z2. U1 is...
Quick question about the ferromagnetic.
Right.
Does the spin rotate in one of the vortices, or can you just put it in the superfluid phase?
I'm sorry, say that again. What is the spin?
So you have two types of vortices for the ferromagnetic state.
You really have one kind of vortex. Right.
Can that be, does the spin rotate, or is it just...
It's a 180 degree disclination. It's one where the spin. Right. You could have it purely in the phase here because it's topologically stable. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. But there's only one topologically stable vortex, if you like, which. No, I think not. I think you can't. I mean, at least the example that I know has it, certainly has it in the phase, but I don't think you can construct something that's purely in the spin. So in this particular case, you have a U1, which is nothing but a one sphere or a circle, and an S2, which is a two sphere, the surface of a three-dimensional sphere now, so, and hence blue instead of orange. Orange in the previous case was the surface of a four-dimensional sphere. So the manifold basically is parametrized by the surface of a three-dimensional sphere and a circle at every point on the sphere to give you the U1. Now the Z2 identification tells you that points which are diametrically opposite on the surface of the sphere and on corresponding circles are identified. So if you look at a point like this and some point on its associated circle, the point that it's equivalent to is a point that's diametrically opposite on the sphere and also diametrically opposite on the associated circle. So this is a little more difficult to visualize. But now, in this particular manifold, you essentially have, if you like, two classes of topological defects. Two classes of closed loops. So in one kind of closed loop, you basically form a contractible closed loop on the surface of the two-dimensional sphere, and you go around an integer number of times on the associated circle as you are traversing along this closed loop. So this is one class of closed loops, which I'll call A and label with an integer index for the number of windings around the circle, and E for the fact that, you know, E just like in the previous case to denote that I have a contractible loop on the two-dimensional sphere. So this is one kind of non-contractible loop. The other kind of non-contractible loop is when I have a loop which goes to a diametrically opposite point on the sphere and something which winds by 180 degrees around a circle. So this is really coming from, you know, the Z2 identification, the fact that identified points are diametrically opposite on the circle. So the second kind of defect is where, you know, I do this on the sphere and go around 180 degrees on the circle. So this I'll call defect type B, and this has I'll identify using this particular form, this particular kind of label. G simply tells you that you're going to a diametrically opposite point on the surface of the two sphere, and n plus 1/2 tells you that you wound around the circle an integer plus 1/2 number of times. So these are the two classes of contractible loops, and which would correspond to topological defects. And now you can show that when you concatenate these defects, which tells you the group operation, A concatenated with A gives you another A, B concatenated with B gives you an A, and A and B concatenated give you B. And this shows you the abelian nature, that it doesn't matter which way I concatenate them. So this is the group structure, this basically follows from the fact that a concatenation operation involves adding the integer labels and a Z2 multiplication in the Z2 labels. But because of the fact that, you know, this only has, in some sense, even integers and this only has odd integers, the Z2 identification becomes redundant as far as the group operation is concerned. So you can essentially just label all these contractible loops or all the topological defects with just an integer. I mean, this is exactly the group operation for just even and odd integers. So what this means is that, you know, the Z2 label is redundant, and the homotopy group of this particular manifold is just z. It's just the group of integers under addition. But the fundamental vortex, okay, now z is also the homotopy group of just a simple u1, of a ground state manifold which is just u1. But that doesn't mean that the topological defects are identical to that, and I'll come to that in a second. I mean, even though the homotopy group is the same, the fundamental vortex is significantly different. Now, one other thing which I should point out, which has been a source of some confusion in the literature, is that this manifold with this global Z2 identification is not equal to this manifold. It had been misidentified this way. And this is really the manifold of something like a smectic. And this is not a smectic. This is something that's different. And this also has a different homotopy group and different kinds of topological defects. So we have identified the homotopy groups of the manifolds and looked at the topological defects. So what do we see from that? We see that the ferromagnetic condensate only has these Z2 defects. It doesn't have vortices. There are no stable vortices, and you can call these defects kermions. It turns out that the one defect corresponding to G actually is like a coreless vortex in some sense. So it's like a skirmion. It doesn't have the condensate order parameter doesn't diverge as you go to the core of this thing. It actually goes to zero. Now you can ask about what happens to point defects in higher dimensions. So these topological defects, the first homotopy group corresponds to point defects in just two dimensions. You can ask about point defects in higher dimensions, and that would really correspond to higher order homotopy groups. So in particular, if you're looking at point defects in three dimensions, that corresponds to the second homotopy group, pi 2, and that in the case of SO3 is trivial. I mean, there are no point defects in three dimensions in the ferromagnetic condensate. The polar condensate, on the other hand, does have vortices because the homotopy group is Z and you can label things using integers. But the fundamental vortex is something which combines a pi phase rotation, a pi rotation in the phase, with a magnetic inversion. So by magnetic, I mean an inversion in the axis of spin quantization. So that is what the fundamental vortex does. It combines a pi phase rotation with a magnetic inversion, and this particular system actually does turn out to have point defects in three dimensions or monopoles, because the second homotopy group of this is actually not trivial. It's equal to Z, so this is something which will in three dimensions have monopoles. Okay, so now let's look at the superfluid transition in two dimensions. So what do we know about two-dimensional finite temperature transitions? So the Mohmann-Wagner theorem tells us that if you break a continuous symmetry, which is what we're doing in both these cases, you will have no true long-range order. But under certain circumstances, you can have quasi-long-range order, like in the case of spinless bosons, when the broken symmetry is U1. So quasi-long-range order is possible, and you can describe the low-temperature behavior. You can investigate that possibility in terms of a nonlinear sigma model, and you can, at least in the simplest case, do a perturbative renormalization group flow and look at the stiffness of the order parameter in the nonlinear sigma model, which you can calculate in using the renormalization group. Now, it turns out that if you're doing this, by perturbative, I mean a renormalization group technique which is blind to topological defects. You can also do a non-perturbative RG, which is significantly more complicated. But because the perturbative renormalization group is blind to the global geometry of the manifold, it depends only on the local structure of the order parameter manifold. So things like Z2 identifications are unimportant from the point of view of a perturbative renormalization group. Okay. So again, so this is just a simple renormalization group beta equation for an ON model in D dimensions. This is to lowest order, and this is the effective temperature that the system is in. The small n is the same as the large n, and this is the number of dimensions. Now, if you happen to be in two dimensions, if D is strictly equal to 2, then to lowest order, you can see that if n is greater than 2, then you're always flowing away from the low temperature fixed point. And that's the reason you don't have any order at finite temperature in these Owen models in two dimensions for n greater than 2. I mean, this is just a Merman-Wagner theorem, if you like. Now, for n equals 2, to this order, this is marginal. There is no flow. And it turns out that you actually have the beta function is marginal to all orders in perturbation theory. So what you end up, what the perturbative renormalization group tells you is that you have a line of critical points. I mean, because this beta function is always marginal. But the reason you still have a phase transition in the n equals 2 case, which is nothing but, U1 symmetry breaking, is that there are the topological defects which you haven't considered in this perturbative renormalization group, and that gives you a phase transition, which is this Costeless-Salis transition, where you basically have an unbinding of these topological defects and a proliferation of vortices. So what do you expect from similar considerations in our case? Okay, so let's again look at the nonlinear sigma model to lowest order. Now, if you have something like if you look at the SO3 manifold, which is S3 mod Z2, as far as perturbative renormalization group is concerned, this is locally like S3, and S3 really corresponds to the same universality class as an O4 model. So because n is greater than 2, you would expect from these considerations that the ferromagnetic condensate is actually disordered at finite temperature in two dimensions. Okay. Now, if you look at the other manifold.
What about V2,
V4? Well, okay, so they don't have logarithmic interactions as far as I know. I mean, there's been some talk. So I believe what happens in systems like this is that you do see a proliferation of Z2 defects at some temperature, which actually also gives you a peak in the specific heat. But if you look at the low temperature correlations, like if you look in the classical Heisenberg model or something, and if you look at the spin-spin correlations at low temperature, they always remain short-ranged. So even though you...
And does it just have one elastic constant?
This one, yes.
Even though there is
right
charge,
right,
freedom, spin degree freedom, it doesn't allow...
Right. It has just one it just has one stiffness.
But yeah, it twists purely in the phase, or purely in the spin, they have the same elastic
That's true within the nonlinear
sigma model, right?
Fluctuations within the low energy manifold, that's true. It wouldn't be true if you included fluctuations sort of out of that manifold. So that is the action on which these RG flows are defined.
Right.
It's just derivative of...
But at low temperatures,
that's true. Okay.
Yeah. Exactly. But, so I think there's some debate in the literature about whether one should in any way...
Sometimes there's a superfluid stiffness for mass transport and spin stiffness, and they're the same.
Right. Exactly.
The asymptotic stiffness is zero, so they're both the same.
Right.
So whether the...
Flow to zero together.
Together, yes.
They start off on the bare level different, presumably. Somehow they must flow together and then...
Well,
there's
a new field.
They're the same, exactly.
No, I'm saying in a real system.
In a real system, yes.
Where they, under normalization, flow together as they went to zero? Did you think about that?
I think they would.
No, we haven't. Yeah, so whether the proliferation of Z2 defects can be interpreted in any way as a phase transition, I don't know. But that's
the same question down here. You've got the same elastic constant.
Right. Right, exactly.
Is that, again, expected to be true, or is that still...
Oh, you mean the fact that this flows to zero?
Oh, you've got gamma grad phi squared.
Right,
gamma.
Yeah, so again, in mean field theory, yes. I mean, if you write down...
Well, the difference is, here they start the same, but flow differently.
Right.
In the pocket case,
the same.
Why do they start?
Well, why do they...
Level, right?
Right. At the mean field level, they start the same.
But the real system, of course...
They could start differently, right? But no matter what happens,
what do they mean by real system? Because if it's a condensate, you simply write the direction of the rotors when discussing the gradient term. It's really very simple.
I think the fact that they're the same is really a consequence of this U1 cross SO3 symmetry. I mean, if you made them different, you wouldn't have a U1 cross SO3 symmetry anymore.
You can have that, for instance, if you put it on a lattice, you would have different stiffnesses for both, but you would still have the
right.
Even the difference, even if they start differently, it doesn't matter. asymptotically, because one of them is being
driven to zero and the other one is not. Right, exactly. So, exactly. So, you know, so the Z2 identification is not important in this perturbative RG, and in the polar case, you write down the energy as, you know, as this, and it turns out that these two stiffnesses are the same in mean field theory. So what you'd expect from a perturbative RG is that this one would flow to zero, you know, at least to lowest order, and that this one would remain marginal. But then the question is, are there any higher order couplings between these that you can generate? And we haven't really answered that question analytically, but what we've done is looked at a Monte Carlo simulation of these systems to confirm what we expect from a lowest order perturbative nonlinear sigma model analysis. Okay. So purely on the basis of everything that I've told you so far, this is what we can say about the polar condensate. That the fundamental vortex has one half flux quantum, if you like. It's something which has a pi phase rotation. And if there is a I should have mentioned this. So here what you'd expect is that, you know, this would flow to zero. This remains marginal. So you could have a KT transition in this sector because, you know, this is, the manifold is flat. But if there is a KT transition, then that is mediated by half vortices because the fundamental vortex has one half flux quantum. Now, so a consequence of that is that the stiffness jump that I mentioned earlier would now be four times the regular Kossler-Thaler stiffness jump because it's mediated by half vortices and not full vortices. Now, so a consequence of all this is that if you look at the low temperature phase, you have algebraic order in 2 theta instead of theta. So the low temperature phase is really like a 2D nematic, a nematic where the directors of the molecules, if you like, are forced to lie in a plane. So this is like a 2D nematic, and if you wanted to write down an order parameter, by which I mean the combination of the spinner fields which picks out 2 theta, it's really this particular combination, the singlet combination of 2 bosons. So what that also tells you about the low temperature phase is that it's really a phase of paired singlets of bosons. And this paired state is incidentally formed here by thermal fluctuations. There are no interactions that we put in to favor a state like this. So, you know, so it's like saying that if you look at the polar state, the mean field polar state, that is something which necessarily requires you to pick out a spin quantization direction, which requires you to break S2, if you like. But you can't do that at finite temperature in 2 dimensions. So therefore, what the system does is it ends up forming these paired singlets of bosons, so you don't have to break an S2 anymore. So the mean field state is unstable to the formation of these paired singlets by thermal fluctuations in 2 dimensions. So that really is our main result here. And we've checked that with Monte Carlo simulations. You start with a free energy functional, which gives you the same ordered states as, you know, as what we got from mean field theory. And the simplest such free energy functional is something which looks like this, where B0 and B2 are like the C0 and C2 that I mentioned earlier. In particular, you know, the B2, the spin-spin coupling, has the same sign as C2 that I mentioned to distinguish between the ferromagnetic and the antiferromagnetic state. And the diagnostic tool to identify a Kossler-Thaler-like transition is the silicity modulus, or is the phase stiffness, which you can, which is basically the change in the free energy, the second derivative of the free energy with respect to an applied phase twist, as in one direction as the twist goes to zero. So this is the, you know, the stiffness of the phase or the silicity modulus, and you can look at this as a function of temperature in a free energy functional like this, and see if there's a jump or not. So these are some classical Monte Carlo results on that particular free energy functional. So this is the gamma that I wrote down as a function of temperature for the polar condensate. Okay, this probably hasn't come out very clear for the different system sizes. And so this is what you'd expect in a regular Costello-Salis transition, one that was driven by vortices. This is what you'd expect the stiffness jump to be, 2t over pi, but you can see that the actual jump, to the extent you could see one in for these system sizes, happens at a larger value, which actually does correspond to 8t over pi. So if you just eyeball this, and you draw a 2t over pi line and an 8t over pi line corresponding to a transition mediated by vortices and half vortices, the jump is certainly closer to the one due to half vortices. You can actually do a little better than this in the numerics, just eyeballing. So it turns out that if you integrate the KT-RG equations, the helicity modulus exactly at the transition has a certain scaling form with the size of the system, and it's this logarithmic form. And gamma infinity here is the magnitude of the jump. So what you can then do is you can look at the goodness of fit of this data to a form like this at different temperatures, and you can see that at one. So the pluses and the asterisks basically represent different sets of system sizes. So you know, you basically take a certain bunch of system sizes and do a fit to this particular form for that set of system sizes. You take another one and you know, you do the fit and you look at the goodness of fit as a function of temperature, and you can see that there's one particular temperature at which there is a minimum. You know, the fit is better than on either side, and this is the one that you identify as the transition temperature, and it turns out to actually have a jump of 8TC over pi, which is what you'd expect from a transition mediated by half vortices. And something very similar to this has also been seen in a two-color lattice QCD model in 2 plus 1 dimensions. You can actually get the equivalent of the polar state there, and you see a similar anomalous stiffness jump, if you like. And this is work that's been done by Shailesh Chandrasekharan. Okay, so the conclusion, so the main conclusion of this part was that if you look at, in two dimensions, if you look at the spinner condensates, in the spin one condensates, and you look at the ferromagnetic and the antiferromagnetic condensate, the antiferromagnetic condensate has this anomalous Costello-Salis transition mediated by half vortices, and the low temperature phase is really a phase of paired singlets. So the mean field state in two dimensions is unstable to the formation of singlets in two dimensions, and the ferromagnetic condensate doesn't have a 2D superfluid transition. So it actually remains disordered, not even quasi-long range ordered at any finite temperature in two dimensions. Okay, now you can do other interesting things with these spin one systems, with these spinner condensates, and one of them is switching on a magnetic field. Now, how much more time do I have?
15.
Okay, good. So I can get through this and also talk about the dynamics a little bit. So what you're doing is you have these things in an optical trap and you switch on a magnetic field, which is different from actually putting these things in a magnetic trap. And the difference is that in a magnetic trap, you're putting all the atoms in one particular spin state, in a state with one particular value of SC. Here, on the other hand, once you've condensed, so in a magnetic trap, you condense all the atoms in a particular state of SC. Here, you first form the condensate with all the spin components mixed, and then you switch on a magnetic field. Now, it turns out that when you do that, the system actually doesn't have the time to magnetize. It doesn't have the time to form a magnetic moment, because the time scale over which that happens ends up being larger than the lifetime of the condensate. So as far as the energetics is concerned, what this means is that the effect of the magnetic field is manifested only in a quadratic Zeeman term. The linear Zeeman term doesn't, you know, it just gives you a constant shift in energy, if you like, but there's no dynamics, and you know, it doesn't affect the energetics in any way. So if you had to write down the energy of this condensate in the presence of a magnetic field, the magnetic field would couple through a quadratic Zeeman term like this. You're applying the field along some z direction, and G2 contains basically some coupling and the strength of the magnetic field. So you can then ask what the phase diagram of the spin one condensates would be with these two parameters, C2 and G2. So everything that we've been discussing so far has been along this line with G2 equal to zero. And now you can you can switch on a G2 and you can ask what sort of phases you get, and this is what the phase diagram looks like, the mean field phase diagram looks like. And so there are interesting phases, each with interesting properties. So for instance, if you look here, so this is the polar condensate with a sine of G2 that's negative, you end up with two coupled U1. So this is basically a polar in plane phase. So you're applying the magnetic field in the Z direction, and you have a mean field state, which is choosing a spin quantization axis that's in the plane perpendicular to the magnetic field. So there's one U1 for the phase and one U1 for the direction of the spin quantization axis, but there is also a Z2 identification in this case. And this is interesting because you now have coupled vortices and you can actually get some interesting KT physics as a result of this coupling between vortices. And this is work that's, you know, being done by Daniel Ashwin and Shailesh Chandrasekharan. So you can ask Danny if you have any questions about this. Now, on this, because this is probably in some sense the most boring part of the phase diagram, this is polar out of plane, so you know, so you apply a magnetic field and you have basically a polar state with spin projection zero in the direction of the magnetic field. Now, the ferromagnetic cases are perhaps more interesting. So if you have G2 less than zero with a ferromagnetic, G2 less than zero in a ferromagnetic condensate, then it turns out that the ground state manifold is actually U1 cross Z2, and this is a ferromagnetic out-of-plane state. So what this means is that you form a condensate where you have spin projection plus one or minus one along the applied magnetic field direction, and that gives you a Z2, and the condensate has a U1 phase. And you know, so this is something, so this kind of order parameter manifold is reminiscent of what happens in frustrated magnets. So for instance, if you take something like an XY antiferromagnet on a triangular lattice, which frustrates it, or even on a square lattice where you put a pi flux through every plaquette to frustrate it, you end up with and a ground state manifold which, you know, looks like this. There, of course, the U1 corresponds to the angle of the spins, and the Z2 corresponds to a chirality. But you know, it's interesting to ask what the order of the phase transitions is, and you have one transition for this and one transition for that, and what is the order of these things? And it turns out, so that's something which we've addressed numerically in two dimensions, and it turns out that you have an Ising-like transition for the Z2 and a Costless-Salis-like transition for the U1, where the Ising transition happens at a higher temperature than the Costless-Salis transition. And this is also a trend which you normally see in frustrated magnets. This part of the phase diagram, you actually have a line which separates a ferromagnetic in-plane phase from a polar out-of-plane phase, and you have a continuous quantum phase transition at the mean field level going across this line. Now, what's interesting about this particular quadrant is that it's also experimentally accessible. So the experiment that I, you know, the experiment of magnetic imaging that I mentioned earlier was really being done in this particular quadrant. So you can actually go across this line and then look at the nature of the quantum phase transition and the dynamics. So there are very interesting things which can be done with the quadratic Zeeman field, and this is what the phase diagram looks like. Okay, so let me conclude and present a summary of this part and then quickly talk about some of the dynamics issues that we're investigating. So what we've shown is that, you know, first of all, the spin one condensates are interesting and they have interesting topological defects. And you know, you have two categories, ferromagnetic and antiferromagnetic or polar. And the ferromagnetic condensate remains disordered in two dimensions at finite temperature, whereas the polar condensate is something which actually has a Costless-Salis-like transition mediated by half vortices, and the polar state is unstable to the formation of a paired superfluid at finite temperature. So that's the conclusion. So these are the conclusions and the summary of the first part of the talk, or part one, and part epsilon is going to be phase ordering kinetics of these spinner condensates. So here I'm not going to go into any details really, but please feel free to ask me and discuss them with me afterwards. But here are some of the issues regarding phase ordering kinetics, and you know the issues that we're trying to address. So what people are doing in experiments is they're looking at the formation of magnetic domains due to the spin. And the way you do that in a typical experiment is that you basically start the system off in some state which doesn't have this magnetic order and quench it down to a state which actually does, which should have magnetic order, and you look at the development of these domains. So in the actual experiment being done in Stampelkund's group, what you really do is you do a quench not in temperature. You can, I mean, that's the most common kind of quench, that you basically heat the system up and it isn't ordered and then cool it down and see how the order develops. Here what they actually do is a magnetic field quench. So they start the system off in, you know, in a state which is this part of the phase diagram, and they quench it to a state there, and they look at the development of ferromagnetic order in plane. So that's the sort of experiment that they're doing. That's the kind of quench that they're doing. Okay, so you can do all these quenches, and what you can do is the experiments, you know, like the Stampelkund experiment, can actually directly image magnetic domains after the initial quench. So then you can ask all kinds of questions in the context of these spinner condensates that you do in the context of order formation in other systems. You know, so for instance, what is the correct dynamic universality class?
The observation of the domains is destructive?
No.
Same domain,
right?
Multiple times.
Exactly, and then that's this.
I saw those pictures.
Yeah.
No correlation from time to time, which may be assumed it was a destructive imaging.
No, as far as I know, it's not. It's not destructive. They don't destroy the condensate when they're doing the imaging.
They can look at the minimal motion.
Yes, exactly.
Pictures, and there's no correlation from
Well, there's some correlations. So
we can go back and
okay. Look at that. Okay. Five minutes. So so issues like, you know, what are the dynamic universality class? How do domains form? What sort of scaling laws exist, and so on? And are quantum effects important at experimental timescales? By which I mean the following thing: that when people, so far, what people have done in looking at domain formation is basically used, you know, if you like, mean field dynamics, so dynamics of the mean field state as given by the Gross-Pitiewski equation, which really treats the, you know, which ignores quantum fluctuations of any sort. But then you could also put them in and ask what happens to the dynamics. And this has also been addressed to some extent by Austin Lamacraft. But the one thing which all these things ignore is the presence of a normal cloud. You know, so you have the condensate and you also have the rest of the system. Now, if the condensate could be made to live sufficiently long over large timescales, it could presumably interact with the rest of the system and be aware of global conservation, aware of conservation laws which apply to the condensate, which apply across the condensate and the rest of the system. So what happens when you do that? And that brings us into the realm of, you know, of phase ordering kinetics in general. So where you ask what sort of conservation laws are important and what effect they have on the dynamics of domain formation and so on. And, you know, so the question is, when are they important? What are the timescales? And what effect do these various conservation laws have on the dynamics? So we have addressed this to some extent, where we have looked at certain finite temperature dynamical models where we bring in the effect of temperature, where we bring in the effect of thermal fluctuations explicitly, and also put in a normal cloud. And one can write down dynamical models for all these situations with keeping track of all the conservation laws. And, you know, these have been classified earlier by Hohenberg and Halperin. So the things which are applicable to superfluid, so to say, which are applicable in a superfluid context, are what are called model A and model F. So model A is something which, you know, where the condensate actually isn't aware of the normal cloud, but is in contact with the heat bath. So there are fluctuations in the condensate density, and all kinds of conservation laws are thus removed because of these thermal fluctuations. So, you know, so this is the condensate in contact with the heat bath with no conservation laws of any sort, and it doesn't know about the normal cloud. And one can ask what the effect of, you know, in some sense, temperature alone in a model like this is on coarsening dynamics, is on phase ordering kinetics. Then you can put in the normal cloud, which is what's called model F, and model F is a model where you have the condensate field and also something called a second sound mode, which is basically a conserved mass energy mode between, which basically reflects the fact that mass and energy are globally conserved between the normal cloud, are conserved between the normal cloud and the condensate. So this is how the condensate is talking to the normal cloud. Now the magnetization of the condensate is not conserved as is in this model, but you can put in magnetization conservation by hand into these models. Now I should emphasize that these, in addition to just taking into account different conservation laws, have some more physics in this, verifiable physics in the sense that they belong to different dynamic universality classes. So scaling and so on are different in these models. So what we've done is we've compared these models at finite temperature with and without a normal cloud and with these conservation laws to what people have done so far. You know, mainly this Gross-Pitiewski kind of analysis where everything is conserved. Magnetization is conserved, particle number is conserved, energy is conserved, and so on. So here's what we've done. So here's the actual analysis that we've done. We've actually looked at two-dimensional formation of these Ising domains. We picked this particular part of the phase diagram because it's the only part of the phase diagram where there's true long-range order in the magnetization sector, and you can meaningfully talk about domains and so on. So we picked this particular quadrant, so we sort of mimicked the experiment by starting the system out from here and quenching it quickly into this quadrant, and asked what the size of the magnetic domains was as a function of time. Now, you normally expect that at large times, the domain size would go as t to the 1 over z, where z is a dynamic critical exponent. This is what you expect from dynamic critical phenomena. So we've numerically simulated all those models that I mentioned and compared z for different models. So let me quickly mention the results. So what we find is that, so remember that we're looking at the formation of magnetic domains. Now, if I didn't have magnetization conservation, then Z turns out to be 2 for models A and F, even though F has this extra second sound conservation law. This doesn't seem to affect the domain formation at large timescales. You still get the same dynamic critical exponent. But on the other hand, if you switch on magnetization conservation, we looked at the particular case where the total magnetization of the system was equal to 0, like in these experimental situations, then Z ends up being equal to 3 for both these models. And it turns out that Z is also equal to 3 for the Gross-Pitiewski equation that people have looked at, where everything is conserved. Magnetization is automatically conserved in number and energy and so on. Now we do know that magnetization conservation is important to dynamics of magnetic domain formation. This is work that David had done in the 80s looking at the Ising model. But there the quench was a little different. There it was a high temperature quench, where it was the ordering of the Ising model in two dimensions with and without magnetic conservation, and you get exactly the same exponents. You get an exponent of 3 if you have magnetization conservation, you have an exponent of 2 if you don't. Okay? So in that sense, maybe something like this is not surprising. Yes, what is affecting the formation of magnetic domains is only whether magnetization is conserved or not. But then there's also, but it's also known that the second sound actually does make a difference. For instance, in superfluid ordering, where models A and F actually give you different critical exponents if you're looking at the ordering of not the the spin part, not of the magnetization part, but of the phase part, the superfluid ordering. And the fact that you have an extra conservation law in F and not in A actually does give you different exponents. But in this case, it turns out that that extra conservation law in F is not particularly important. So if you had to ask what is the right dynamical model for these condensates at large times, it is likely to be model F, but perhaps with magnetization conservation, depending on what time scales you're talking about. I mean, model F is something which is justified from microscopics in some sense, and you know that there has to be a conserved second sound mode if the condensate talks to the normal cloud. So in doing all this, what we're ultimately trying to get at is what the right dynamical model is at long times and finite temperature for these condensates. And we think it's model F, but whether magnetization conservation is important or not is a question of time scales. So I'll end with a slide on some of the questions that we are in the process of addressing with regard to dynamics and statics. And if you have any questions, please ask.
Yeah. Question, actually, I guess I missed the statement. So in your actually the setup of your dynamic problem. So the quench takes you just deep into the
into this phase, deep into the ordered phase at a temperature which is lower than, you know, either of these ordering temperatures.
At the very end of the relaxation process, you will be deep below
exactly
the critical point.
Right.
And in this case, I do not understand what they mean by critical exponents or dynamical exponents. You were mentioning some exponents.
Well, okay. All I'm saying is that the domains form, you know, so the domains grow as a function of time. It's a non-equilibrium critical exponent.
The dynamic of the domain.
Of the domain formation, yes.
I see. So basically,
right.
I understand, because it's just like the relaxation of superfluid turbulence.
Exactly. So this is really the critical exponent which you can, you know, which is sort of...
It's not really critical, right?
Well, okay, an exponent, fine.
Yes.
Okay, an exponent.
It's a critical phenomenon.
It's a dynamic critical
phenomenon.
Critical
it's
phenomenon.
Right. But in terms of superfluid turbulence, nobody calls it critical. Just the relaxation of stuff.
But it's a scale invariant process.
Right.
Almost in case of superfluid. You have your logs.
Well, I mean, you do have. You know, I mean, this is what you get at large times, but you do have small corrections to this, and yeah, but it is scale invariant.
Almost. In the case of superfluid turbulence, you have logs because your vortices are turned to logs.
Right. Well, even in this case, you could have logs. So one of the things where you do get you mean in addition to something like e to the 1 over z, you can have a log t. Is that right? So one case where you get that is if you're looking at the formation of superfluid domains in two dimensions, right? So let's say, you know, you take a 2D.
Dimensions, we just have point wise.
Yeah. But okay, but what you're doing, but the setup is that...
Process.
Right, sure. Exactly. So what you do there is, you know, you quench the system from a high temperature to a temperature higher than the KT transition to lower than the KT transition. And you ask, you know, the same question, how do the superfluid domains grow with time?
Yes, question, how your vortices bear.
Exactly. Because that's what's giving you the superfluid order. And there you have a log.
The state is not a superfluid turbulence, right? You have local order and you have long
order. Right.
And you just ask the question how the system gets rid of the topological.
Right.
Apart from the equilibrium.
Right, exactly.
So
I guess what I was trying to say is that, you know, if you had topological defects during your quench, then you would get a log. If you didn't have them, you wouldn't get the log.
Basically, it's the law of getting rid of
topology. Exactly. But even without the topological defects, you could still, I guess, talk about.
Wait
a moment. Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Yeah, but. Right. No, but they're not point defects. But they're not topological point defects.
Depends on the system.
Right. Yeah.
In the superfluid, it aligns in 3D points and should be maybe any differences.
Yeah.
Other questions?
So the numerics, I didn't quite get into those. That can capture topological defects.
Yes. Yes. You know, I mean, even these numerics, sort of, even without the dynamics, even the statics capture topological defects. That's the reason you get this transition. You know, just the free energy has everything in it.
Go back to Stanford Parent's pictures.